Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Matt Harris. Matt is a managing director at Bain Capital Ventures, the VC division of Bain Capital, with $60 billion in assets under management. For most of Matt's career, he's been focused on financial technology. He was most recently ranked number 3 among the FinTech Finance 40. At Bain Capital Ventures, Matt has invested in numerous fintech companies, some of which he explores in this interview. Prior to joining BCV in 2012, Matt founded Village Ventures and spent 12 years leading that firm. In this interview, Matt analyzes how the fintech competitive landscape has dramatically shifted over his career. From the domination of large financial institutions, which grew ever larger through mergers and acquisitions, to the emergence of startups. We also discuss Matt's interest in real estate technology, insurtech, his views on Bitcoin and blockchain, what he looks for when making an investing decision, and a variety of other topics. Matt Harris, welcome to the broadcast. It's great to speak with you today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm really glad to be here.
Excellent. Well, Matt, you are a managing director at Bain Capital Ventures, and your area of focus is fintech. And one of the things I thought we would begin with, you have mentioned that with regard to fintech, you've seen sort of discrete chapters emerge in fintech, and with each of these being areas of interest for you and areas of focus, and in some cases, areas where you have invested. And I wonder if you could define some of those discrete chapters for us.
Well, you know, this goes back quite a long ways. I started investing in fintech in the early 2000s, so 102. I had invested in some financial technology companies prior to that, but really it became my sole focus 17 years ago or so. And part of the reason for my interest was there wasn't a lot of activity. You know, there certainly weren't a lot of VCs or any that I could find who were similarly exclusively focused. So it felt like an opportunity. But what fintech there was back then was really vendors. It was companies building technology to sell to financial services companies, what I began to call the incumbents, the existing banks and broker dealers and insurance carriers, all of whom bought technology. But my view was they generally preferred to buy technology from other big companies, whether they be, you know, industry-focused players like Fiserv and FIS and Jack Henry, or big companies like Accenture and IBM. And so to me, the opportunity was not back then in building the new vendors to make the incumbents be more successful. Real opportunity in kind of phase one of fintech was building competitors, was identifying areas where the existing incumbent providers of financial services were not sufficiently focused on their customers and certainly weren't delighting their customers with innovative technology-driven products. And so in this phase, you saw companies like Simple, which was a, you know, a competitive retail banking product built on mobile apps and novel forms of interaction. You had companies like LendingClub and OnDeck and Square and Braintree, companies attacking the various aspects of what we now think of as fintech, payments, lending, investing, insurance, and doing so directly by competing with the incumbents. So that was sort of phase one. And in the beginning, the incumbents ignored the startups. Then you had the financial crisis, and they went from ignoring them because they thought they were insignificant to ignoring them because they had way bigger problems to deal with. And so really the sort of beginning of modern fintech began about 10 years ago when you had this global financial crisis, which convinced all of the incumbents that they were in a fight for survival against the regulators, allowing a lot of room for innovators to build businesses. And then you had Square get started, which was a seminal moment when you had Jack Dorsey, who had already made himself famous for starting Twitter, turn his attention to the payments industry and to fintech. And that sort of legitimized the sector for lots of folks. So it was sort of the starting gun, if you will, and certainly the time when my career went from being obscure and hard to explain to being something that more people understood. And just fast forwarding a few years, when the banks started to recover from the global financial crisis and the companies I mentioned had actually gotten some scale, and, you know, robo-advisors had emerged, companies like Sigfig and Betterment and Wealthfront and Personal Capital. So in every corner of financial services, even insurance, probably the last to move, you had companies like Oscar and Lemonade. Then the incumbents started to pay attention. And Jamie Dimon wrote an iconic portion of his annual letter to shareholders about Silicon Valley is coming. This was in perhaps 2012. And that's marked the kind of most recent phase in the last 5 years of fintech, where banks and broker-dealers and insurance carriers and other industry incumbents have fully recognized the threat of technology-enabled entrepreneurially led competitors, and have actually, for the first time, become pretty good customers for new vendors. So that business model that I disdained 17 years ago of selling tech to incumbents is actually newly pretty interesting, because despite their propensity to have this incredibly burdensome procurement process, given the goad of these new competitors coming from Silicon Valley and New York and other technology centers, the incumbents have been forced to react by realizing that Accenture and IBM were not going to solve their problems. And so you're seeing strength in every corner now of financial technology, both the challengers, these new brands that are building customer bases, as well as new vendors who are selling modern technology elegantly designed and delivered to the incumbents in the hopes of maintaining their competitiveness. So that, in a nutshell, a pretty large nutshell, is the potted history of fintech.
That's great. And I, you know, it's interesting you talk about the rise of the entrepreneurs and startups and the evolution of that, the sea change that happened with Square and Jack Dorsey's involvement in this. And then in the later portions of your response, it brings to mind the fact that we're seeing to a greater extent a bit of co-opetition, where you have startups partnering with the behemoths while also competing with them. And I wonder if you could maybe take a moment to reflect upon the business models that are emerging and the ecosystem that is developing as a result of this co-opetition that exists.
Yeah, so it's really driven by two forces. One I mentioned, which is that banks have recognized that they can't build all of the delightful new technology that their customers want, and their existing vendors aren't providing it. So on one hand, there's this new openness to collaborating with startups. And in the startup community, well, there have been some breakout success stories like Square and Stripe and OnDeck and some of the others I've mentioned. Plenty of startups have hit the wall when it comes to distribution. You know, there's this famous line about the competition is to see whether a startup can figure out distribution before the incumbent competition can figure out innovation. That's the race, because the recognition in that line is that the incumbents have the customers, and it's actually awfully hard to pry them away. And so for many startups who began life looking to compete with banks or asset managers, wealth managers, insurance carriers, they've recognized that actually a quicker path to building an important company is to partner with the incumbents, either to sell them technology or to do the equivalent of joint venture work to collaboratively, deploy and develop new technologies to serve the customer base of the incumbent. So there are many examples of this, just of the companies that I've invested in. OnDeck Capital, which is an independent public company now, small business lender, has also put in place major partnerships with companies like JP Morgan. OnDeck has a you know, multi-hundred-million-dollar business making loans to small businesses, but JP Morgan has a multi-billion-dollar business doing the same thing. And now JP Morgan leverages OnDeck's underwriting tools, their onboarding tools, all of the user interface that OnDeck developed for its segment, JP Morgan also uses for their small business borrower customers. One example. Another would be a company, Sigfig, also where I'm an investor, developed a business to consumer robo advisor, similar to Wealthfront and Betterment, but recognized that despite having, you know, hundreds of thousands of customers, that's a tough way to make money, and pivoted to serve existing incumbents. So Wells Fargo and UBS and Citizens Bank and many other large existing financial institutions, all of whom want to develop digital wealth solutions for their customers, recognizing that they can't do it themselves, have leaned heavily on Sigfig to really collaborate on those digital wealth solutions. In the payment space, to give a final example, we have a company called Avid Exchange. Avid is in the commercial payment space, so they help businesses pay their bills and move from laborious workflow, paper-based workflow, and paper checks in accounts payable departments to software-driven workflows and digital payment streams on virtual commercial cards and ACH and other meaningfully less expensive ways to make commercial payments. They built a $100 million plus business selling directly to businesses, selling to accounts payable departments. But last year, they co-developed a product with KeyBank, which they brought to market with Key, and now through a partnership with MasterCard, they're serving what will ultimately be dozens of banks in this collaborative platform where Avid develops the software and the banks bring the customers and the payment rails. So, you know, I could go on, but this synthesis of, you know, dynamic, entrepreneurially led, technology-focused companies backed often by venture capital, combined with the incumbents who have the regulatory status and who have the customer base, is a brand new chapter. You know, in the nearly 20 years I've been doing this, it's really only been in the past 3, 4, 5 years that these collaborations have existed and they're bearing fruit.
Mm. I'd like to hone in on a couple of different segments of fintech. You're, I believe, still on the investment committee of a digital currency group, which you've referred to as a front, providing a front row seat to cryptocurrencies and blockchains. And I'd love to cover each of those, in fact. You know, cryptocurrencies and, of course, Bitcoin most prominently has been in the news quite a bit over the past 18, 24 months as fortunes have been made and some fortunes have been lost with the extraordinary volatility of that. But I wonder sort of what your own thought process is on the evolution of cryptocurrencies and how bullish you are, generally speaking, on them.
I have been referred to as a Bitcoin maximalist is the term of art. I tend to, as it relates to crypto assets, I tend to be dramatically more bullish on Bitcoin than any of the other currencies or assets that have been developed, broadly defined, you know, tokens. I think it is all inherently speculative, predicting prices, but I get the use case for Bitcoin. And I've spent many hundreds of hours talking to owners of Bitcoin. There are no users of Bitcoin, unfortunately, but the owners of Bitcoin tend pretty consistently to believe in Bitcoin the way that for millennia people have believed in gold as a store of value, not necessarily stable on any kind of short-term basis, but a store of value that's divorced from the whims of governments and the vicissitudes and inflationary tendencies of fiat currency. And it's far from universal, this instinct. I've never owned gold in my life. Most people don't own gold, but, you know, mid single digit percentage of people with means end up owning gold and view it as a hedge against inflation and this sort of anarchic hedge against chaos. And for this newer generation of generally younger people, the idea that gold has inherent value doesn't make a lot of sense. And then frankly, other than the fact that it's been valued this way for hundreds of years, there's no inherent logic in gold being valuable. And Bitcoin is far more appealing to this demographic. And so there's, you know, $7 trillion of gold above ground right now, and there's about $200 billion of value in Bitcoin as it stands. And I view that as kind of the market share game. As we think about non-fiat stores of value, what percentage of people are going to want to own the new digital one, and which are going to want to own the venerable shiny metal one? So that to me is the case, the bull case on Bitcoin. And I don't have a crystal ball on where it goes from here, but I've certainly made sure to own a good chunk in my personal account and spend a lot of time on it through DCG. I'd say the second category where I have my conviction is, it follows from the first, that if you believe that people are going to want to invest in and hold Bitcoin and potentially other crypto assets, which I'll return to, then you're going to need a bunch of aspects of market structure to facilitate that. You're going to need trading venues. You're going to need exchanges. You're going to need custody solutions. You're going to need ways to sell short and go levered long on these assets. And you need something called a stable coin if you're going to be trading these non-fiat denominated tokens. You're going to need asset management firms. And so both in DCG, there's some wholly owned businesses in asset management and trading, as well as events and media. But through DCG, you've also invested in 110, now 115 different companies. And many of them are oriented towards these sort of capital market use cases that take as a core tenet that there will be an emerging and evolving market for these assets, and therefore you'll need elements of market structure. So that's another thing that follows from my sort of Bitcoin maximalist view. The third category is I find super intriguing, but there's no evidence yet of its success, which is this notion of distributed application. So, you know, think of these as open source protocols with an internal token. And the idea that the apps we use today as consumers, like Facebook, Uber, Airbnb, et cetera, and that we use as businesses, like, you know, Slack and Outlook, that all of these software-driven tools that are now, you know, they're owned by companies or are companies themselves, should be open source protocols, owned by no one, fueled by tokens that users need to buy and own and use and can earn through the utilization of the, you know, new school version of Uber, Facebook, Outlook, Slack. This is a very big idea. And there are thousands of incredibly high quality teams of engineers and entrepreneurs building these applications, generally on top of Ethereum. And many of them are launching these tokens before they're in use and pre-selling them and using those funds to build the software. And most of them are going to fail. Many of them have already failed, and hundreds of millions of dollars have been lost already or on a mark-to-market basis, because this kind of structure just lends itself to kind of scammy promotional pump-and-dump schemes, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It just means it's subject to abuse. And so this whole world of distributed applications and the associated tokens is one where we've been cautious, but remain, you know, fundamentally intrigued with the ideas that underpin that movement. And then the last segment that we consider is enterprise blockchain. So this notion that the blockchain that underpins Bitcoin and Ethereum, this database architecture, is a radical new innovation, and that there are corporate, generally speaking, corporate use cases within an enterprise or between and among enterprises where there are existing workflows that could be transformatively improved through the deployment of that novel kind of database structure with its distributed nature at the core. And there I've been pretty skeptical. I think there surely will be some use cases, but fewer than is generally believed. And frankly, the real innovation behind Bitcoin is trustlessness, or alternatively permissionlessness. It's this idea that you and I can exchange Bitcoin between each other without having to know who the other one is, without having a central counterparty like a Visa or MasterCard or a DTCC that is standing behind and clearing the transaction. It is really amazing, like magical innovation, that value in the hundreds of billions of dollars can move around without anyone being able to edit or censor those transactions. But that is not something that has utility in the context of corporate entities. You frequently in the enterprise blockchain world hear this phrase, permissioned blockchain, which is like, if you believe that permissionlessness is the most important, in fact, inherent quality of a blockchain, then the idea of a permissioned blockchain is sort of, transparently ridiculous.
Yeah,
right. That is a extremely negative view, and the fact is there's lots of really good people and lots of money working on desperately trying to find a nail for which blockchain is the right hammer, and therefore nails will be found, and there will be projects that work. I'm certain of it, but I suspect when the final analysis is done about all the time and effort and money that went into it, and it's compared to the results in 5 to 7 years, I think people will not find that it was the very best use of resources.
That's interesting. And so do you surmise that all of the time and attention, especially among many large enterprises in investing in this space, is essentially based upon a misunderstanding as to the ultimate value that the technology should have?
No, I think that it's a little bit of an theater, to be honest. I mean, it's if you walked around, Barclays and tried to get people's attention and try to organize resources and budget saying that we need to upgrade all of our databases, that we need to move from relational databases to NoSQL databases or even distributed ledgers, and you beat the drum for that, people would look at you and say, yeah, get in line. Obviously we should upgrade everything here. We should upgrade the chairs. We should upgrade, but we're not going to spend scarce resources, time and attention upgrading the databases because the ROI is just so vague. It's definitely motherhood and apple pie that there are new database structures. And when we went from flat file to relational in the early 90s, it was a good thing to do. It took 15 years, but eventually we moved off of mainframes onto client server, and we moved from flat file to relational, and everything got, better. And we should keep doing it. But nobody was going to start, handing out money and titles and promotions to database upgraders. But blockchain, because of its rise to prominence via Bitcoin, created this enormous opportunity to create like what people call innovation theater. You could go into Jamie Dimon and say, hey, Jamie, I know you hate Bitcoin. You've been super public about that. And you're right. Bitcoin is for drug dealers. But what's interesting is the blockchain. And it was just this incredibly elegant, seemingly super smart thing to say that co-opted the momentum of Bitcoin and made it safe for corporate America, but still thrilling. And a lot of time and resources and budget, therefore, got allocated to database upgrade projects in a way that never would have happened. And I'm glad the databases are getting upgraded. I mean, again, this is a good thing. It's maybe not the highest, best use of scarce resources, but it's a good thing to do. But, you know, when you think about like the truly transformative potential that gets referenced, where you have, you know, it takes 2 days to settle a U.S. equities transaction through DTCC. And if every single stock were on a blockchain or a distributed ledger, it could happen instantly. And it turns out like it could happen instantly today. It's not a technology issue. It's a social issue. You've got thousands of counterparties who are used to a set of standards that would all have to just agree to a new set of standards. Just like in the US, you know, finally, NACHA has developed real-time payment standards. So you can actually do real-time ACH today. It took them 15 years and still no one uses it because you know what? The delay is not a problem in 99.9% of the use cases. And in fact, it's a great thing to have a little bit of delay when you're moving money around because it reduces fraud and risk. So finally, over 15 years, without any distributed ledgers or, you know, blockchains, NACHA figured out how to do real-time payments just by getting the banks to agree to a new set of standards. So A, you don't need blockchains, and B, nobody wants them. So this is my skepticism that right. It's not a technology issue. It's a social issue, and it's generally in service of something that if it were so radically desirable, we'd already have it.
So we will we'll note you as a Bitcoin maximalist and a blockchain minimalist.
exactly. I'll put that on my LinkedIn.
Exactly. Update accordingly. I want to move on to a different topic that I know you're passionate about, and one that actually it gets a lot less press than the topics we've just been covering, and that's real estate tech. In fact, for those who are interested, a part of your thesis there can be found in a Forbes article from earlier this year titled "The Future of Real Estate Tech: How We Got Here and What's Next in Exploding New Ecosystem." And I wonder if you could take a moment and talk a bit about your perspective on real estate tech and why it's an area that has you excited.
Yes. Well, one of the things that we have been active in real estate tech, going back a ways actually, but here in the past 18 months, even more vigorously. And I actually get the question pretty frequently of what real estate tech has to do with fintech. You know, if I've been exclusively focused on financial technology for 18 years, and now I'm writing articles in Forbes about real estate tech or prop tech, like, does this represent a new expansion of my interests, or is it actually the fifth segment of fintech? We'd earlier in the conversation referenced payment, lending, investing, and insurance as kind of the core four segment. Is real estate the fifth? And so I've been thinking a lot about that because there's no doubt that I'm drawn to real estate. It represents a huge amount of economic activity globally, and it has massive inefficiencies and analog processes and technologies that over time will become digital and have already started to become digital. So the opportunity is there. And what I've been finding, what I've found as I reflected on it, is that my skill set, my understanding of fintech and, you know, the aspects I mentioned of payments and lending, investing in insurance, like they just lend themselves to real estate so dramatically. And so to me, increasingly, like I'm excited about real estate. My fintech lens doesn't get me all the way there to becoming a real estate expert, because there are definitely vertically specific idiosyncrasies that need to be understood. When you're thinking about real estate payments, it's meaningfully different than restaurant payments or higher education payments. There are meaningful vertical distinctive elements within real estate. And the same is true of lending. You know, a mortgage is different than an auto loan, et cetera. But it is one of those industries, as I'm learning, as I think more about it, of many, where the four critical aspects of fintech are actually deeply important, and where there are big businesses at the intersection of real estate and payments and real estate and lending and real estate and insurance. In a sense, it does represent some departure from so-called pure fintech. But in another sense, I think it's one of the first of what will end up being, I think, a healthy number of those intersections, where folks like me who are really interested in fintech will start finding cool stuff to do at the intersection of healthcare and payments and lending and insurance and investing, and the intersection of transportation and those core fintech segments, at the intersection of commerce and those core segments. It reminds me, there were VCs back in the late 90s who, when you ask them what their focus was, would say, I mainly invest in internet companies. And you don't hear that anymore. You know, it's like, that sounds archaic to say and archaic to hear, because it's like, well, what does that even mean? Like, every company uses the internet. There's no such thing as a non-internet company. And I don't expect that fintech will become like that pervasive in the way the internet has, but I do think analogously, fintech will be kind of like an ingredient brand. You know, it'll be like, there will be few pure payments companies. More and more payments companies will be vertically oriented. And the skill set will be, yes, understanding payments, but as importantly, understanding real estate or understanding healthcare or higher ed or transportation or travel or whatever the domain is. So I'm sort of waxing rhetorical here, but as I think about the next 10, 20 years of my career, I'm realizing that fintech in and of itself, a lot of the innovations have happened. And the next chapter is about applying those innovations in a vertically specific way.
Very interesting. And as you say, into other domains, other industries, you know, maybe a little bit closer to home based on the sort of more typical fintech or financial services definition is insurtech. And some of the disruption that's happening in that space. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of your perspectives and what you're seeing there.
Yeah, insurtech has been fascinating for me to watch. Insurance is an industry that does not lend itself to disruptive change. And you know, same is true of really any regulated business, but insurance, particularly in the United States, has this patchwork quilt of regulation driven by state insurance commissioners. Such that, like, building a nationwide, disruptive, kind of game-changing insurance product company is, there's no minimum viable product. You've got to really tangle with regulators kind of on day one if you're going to be changing meaningful things. And so as such, it was sort of the last part of fintech to really get moving. You had big payments innovators and major alternative lending companies and lots of innovation in the wealth management and investing space before you saw real dollars going into insurtech. But when it started, it has built meaningfully. So, you know, insurance is multifaceted. The big three buckets were, you know, health insurance. And there's where you saw the first activity, actually, again, at that intersection of healthcare and fintech. Companies like Oscar, Devoted, and other innovators, massively well-funded innovators in health insurance. The next category is property and casualty. So these are, you know, auto insurance, home insurance, renter's insurance, travel insurance, all of the kind of risk-related insurance buckets. And here, too, you've seen companies like Lemonade, Metromile, most recently Root Insurance, was valued at $1 billion and raised $100+ million. To do novel forms of auto insurance. So investors piling hundreds of millions of dollars into the P&C category. And then finally, you have the what we call the wealth category. So life insurance, annuities, all the other insurance products that are meant to protect not so much against risk per se or protect your health, but rather preserve wealth. You've seen fewer companies there. Life insurance, for instance, is the kind of thing where you'll know if you did a good job on risk, you know, 30 years later. So famously hard category to move fast. But there we've seen companies like Ladder and Halo and other businesses raise lots of money and go to work trying to build new types of companies. And so across those three categories, you know, the names I've mentioned have all been carriers. So the other way to segment the insurance space is you have a value chain where you have reinsurance, which is really the people who take most of the risk. Then you have carriers who take some risk and are the really most heavily regulated segment of the value chain. And all the companies I've just mentioned who had raised the most capital are carriers. They're looking to compete in this heavily regulated, risk-bearing segment of the value chain where you can do the most disruption. You can really change how a product works in a way that Oscar Health is meaningfully different than what you can buy from Aetna in terms of the value proposition and how they deliver their product. And then you have brokers. And here we've seen lots and lots of activity. They typically don't have to raise as much money. These are companies like Hippo or Lemonade or Next Insurance or Cover Wallet or Goji, lots and lots of companies who are selling existing insurance products. Generally, they're selling and binding coverages from the Allstates and the Progressives and Prudentials and all the other existing insurance companies, but they're going to market using modern digital methods. And so you see brokers of all type across property and casualty and health and wealth, and there's lots of capital, generally fewer in the way of dollars per company, but still lots of new startups in that space. So I don't see this slowing down anytime soon. I think people are very attracted to the combination of a market size that is as big as you could ever find. Plus, you know, incumbents that are as slow moving as you'll ever see. And so there's this perceived and actual gap between what customers want and what the existing players are delivering, and startups are rushing to fill that void. But personally, I think it's worth remembering that these are very challenging markets from a regulatory perspective, from a risk perspective, from a capital intensity perspective. And so we've been highly selective in this space and made a couple investments, but probably underweight relative to many of our VC competitors who are very excited about InsurTech.
Very interesting. You've mentioned a number of your investments and that you have made. You mentioned in an interview with Institutional Investor, a periodical who ranked you number 3 among the FinTech Finance 40, among the best investors in FinTech Finance. You mentioned that you don't use deal pace as a metric. In fact, in 2016, you only did 2 deals, at least according to the article, 6 of them in 2017, last year. I wonder actually, how do you think about, what are you looking for in investment? Naturally, it's different depending upon the space, I imagine, but if there are some common themes or threads that you could pull through the investments you make, what are some of those common themes?
Well, one of the things I've learned, and there's two dangers, at least two dangers with being so vertically focused, you know, in my case on financial technology. One danger is that it can serve as a form of blinders. So I spend a lot of time thinking about insurance as an example. And so I have some, you know, deeply held beliefs, some of which I'm expressing on this call, or enterprise blockchain for that matter. But great entrepreneurs, you know, change the world. And so like my preconceived notions can be proven wrong by incredible people. That's the whole fun of it. But if I get too married to my own ideas, I'm not going to be able to see that. And in fact, it's going to be a generalist VC who says, with no pre-existing notions, who's going to be the one to back those companies. And they can be some of the most exciting companies, the ones who prove wrong everything I believe. And so I worry about that. And I also worry about falling in love with a company because they match my ideas. You know, if I have a passionate belief about commercial payments and I meet an entrepreneur and he or she has the same belief, you know, that can be really compelling. You know, everyone loves their own ideas and I'm no exception to that. So those are the traps that I fall in. But what I just keep reminding myself, and I don't always succeed, is that's not the important thing. The important thing is just trying to invest with the best people in the world. The best entrepreneurs in the world will figure it all out. Actually, even if their idea is terrible, they'll just figure out a great idea along the way. And so it's sort of motherhood and apple pie, and a little bit trite to say that management is the most important thing. But it's the thing that makes that worth repeating is that it's so easy to forget because there are so many cognitive pitfalls that we fall into when we're trying to remain focused on management quality, but we get inevitably distracted. So, you know, I just keep saying it. I keep reminding myself and I keep making mistakes, but I keep trying to come back to that as the true north, that my job is really to back the best people in the world. And all this domain expertise, all this work I've done trying to get smart about these segments of financial technology and scratch and claw my way up to the number 3 position. I'm not sure that's scientifically derived, but my mother's very proud of it. But you know, all that work, is not so much so that I can be discerning about what's a good deal and what's a bad deal. It's really so that entrepreneurs will pick. It's really so that when I meet that woman or and that man who are just, I think, capable of building the next world-beating company, that when they go to choose somebody to invest in them, because they will have their choice, they're that good, that they look at my sort of fintech nerdiness and say, you know what, I'd like that guy on my board. So that's how I think about it, and that's what I try to prioritize when I'm making investments.
And it's not a surprise that you would talk about the quality of the management team. As you mentioned, it's practically a truism among investors that you would focus on that. But I'm curious, like, how do you evaluate that? How do you, since you are not colleagues of these people, you're not spending, you know, a month or 2 months with them, seeing each decision that they make, seeing how they're treating their team, you know, seeing sort of the things from the ground up on enough of a regular basis to have maybe a fully informed position on that. What's the proxy? What are the ways in which you inform yourself to the point in which you're confident enough to make those investments?
You know, a big part of my job is getting out there and meeting people such that I actually know the entrepreneurs before they come in to pitch me. And I've got, you know, there's one of my role models in venture capital is a guy named Mark Schuster, a very smart guy who talks about, you know, investing should be about lines, not dots. It shouldn't be, you know, a one point in time meeting. It should be a series of interactions that you can draw a line through and therefore know the person relatively well. And so that's, I think, job one. Job two is we get extraordinarily good or at least well practiced at reference checking. You know, the other benefits of having being an old guy, I haven't done this for a long time, is that indeed I haven't worked with them for the last 5 years, likely, but I should know someone who has. And I should have a relationship with somebody who knows them intimately, hopefully several people who do, who owe me enough allegiance that they're going to tell me the truth about the person's strengths and weaknesses. And then I have the evidence in my own eyes. You know, the job really is about when you meet somebody you think might be extraordinary, you're kind of dropping everything to spend time with them. Dinners, you know, spouses, like really getting to know them and deciding whether this is the kind of person you want to go to war with. And therefore, if you only do one or two deals a year, that's fine. How many extraordinary people do you meet in a year? It has to be okay to have that kind of pacing.
That's great. Oh, well, Matt Harris, thank you so much for your comments today. It's been a great and very informative conversation.
That's been my pleasure. I'm really glad we found the time, Peter, and thank you for having me on the show.
Excellent.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join us next week when my guest will be Matt Minatola, the CIO of Travelport.